From KBIA News in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. Today on Intersection, we're talking about native plants, monarch butterflies, and other pollinators. Monarch butterflies have an amazing life cycle. Several generations are born and die in the U.S. and Canada every summer. Then in the late summer and early fall, something changes. Butterflies emerge from their chrysalises, not to live just a few short weeks, but many months. Those butterflies begin a journey south, to forests in the Sierra Madre Mountains in Mexico. There they winter in giant, dense clusters in trees. But something has been changing. 20 years ago, these wintering butterflies covered more than 19 acres of forest. In the winter of 2014 to 2015, they covered less than 3 acres. So what's happening to all those butterflies? Why? And what's being done to address the population decline? To learn more, I talked with Dr. Chip Taylor, the director of the organization Monarch Watch at the University of Kansas in Lawrence.
Milkweed is necessary for monarch butterflies because it's the host plant for the larva. Female monarchs will only lay eggs on milkweed. Generally, there's a few other plants that are of concern because they will lay eggs on them, but the larvae won't develop. But that's not a major problem, at least not here in this part of the country. So what we need to do is propagate milkweeds. We need to get milkweeds out there in the landscape. And we're talking about a lot of species of milkweeds. We're not talking about just one species. We're talking about approximately 20 different species around the country. And because monarchs occupy a large landscape and they use different milkweeds in different seasons. And so we need to provide a variety of resources out there, a rich salad, let's say, of milkweed plants.
Monarch Watch has been distributing these baby milkweed plants called plugs. When did you first start distributing, and how has the number changed over the years?
Well, we gambled in 2013. We asked our grower, Applied Ecological Services, to produce something like 25,000 plugs, and I said, you know, this is a gamble. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get these out there. I may have to eat them all summer, but they're not too good to eat, by the way. They're not the kind of thing you want to put in a salad. But anyway, we got rid of 22,000 of them, overwintered a large number of the rest, and so we were off to a pretty good start. And then we added another nursery last year, and last year we produced about 59,000 plugs across the country. And this year, we think the total is going to become pretty close to 100,000 plants by the time everything gets out the door here. We're still shipping right now. We're going to be shipping a lot of plants this fall for certain parts of the country. We don't have stuff for everybody, for everywhere, but we have plants for certain parts of the Midwest, and we even have a few hundred plants for Texas, and we're going to get those all out the door and get them in the ground.
What are you hoping for in 2016 and 2017?
Well, the numbers keep changing, but right now I'm telling everybody we're probably going to be pushing 300,000 plugs next year, and it could be more than that. It kind of depends on how much money's in the pipe and who wants us to do what. We're piling up orders right now. We just picked up an order for 20,000 plugs for Iowa for next year. So, you know, these things come along pretty well. If we can get the Departments of Transportation on board, we're going to be trying to recruit a lot of other nurseries to help us out. We're working with 4 nurseries this year. We're going to be working with at least 5 next year, maybe 6 or 7.
And could you tell me a little bit about the major factors and the decline in the monarch habitat, and how much area of habitat has been lost?
Yeah, we became aware of the fact that habitat was declining when we saw the glyphosate Roundup being put on croplands. It was eliminating milkweed, and early on in the year 2000, a study was done which showed that the corn and soybean fields were producing more monarchs per acre than almost any other habitat. I mean, by a tremendous difference. I mean, it was about a 20-fold difference. And so it was quite apparent in the year 2000 that corn and milkweeds were really very good for monarchs because there was a low-level contamination of milkweeds in those fields. Then the Roundup Ready corn and soybeans came about, and they were adopted increasingly after the year 2000. And so we got to somewhere around 2006, 2007, and we began to see that the population was really declining and that the milkweed was effectively gone. I mean, it was gone from corn and soybean fields in a matter of a couple of years. And so that's a loss of about 100 million acres of habitat. And then about the same time, 2007, President Bush signed the biofuel initiative to try to get ethanol in all of our gas tanks. And this meant that there was a lot of incentive to produce a lot more corn, because that ethanol was produced from corn. And so we saw an increase from 96 to 2013. We saw an increase of corn acreage and corn and soybean acreage of about 30 million acres, which is bigger than a whole lot of our states. So you add the loss of the habitat in corn and soybeans, and then you add on to that the habitat that was consumed to produce more corn and soybeans after that. You're coming up to about 130 million acres, and then you look at the amount of habitat that's lost each year due to development and due to other things that are going on, and pretty soon you come up with a total that's about equal to the state of Texas, which is 167 million acres of habitat. That's a lot of habitat to lose. So it's not really surprising that the monarch population has declined as a result of that. What is really of great concern is not only the monarch butterflies, but the fact that monarchs share habitats with a whole lot of other species. I mean, there are ground nesting birds out there. There's a whole lot of pollinators out there, small mammals out there. All of those things feed something, and all of those organisms out there are connected somewhere with the habitat and the resilience of the habitat out there. I mean, we're talking about ecosystems here. We're talking about ecosystems that support us and the biodiversity out there that is of interest that we want to keep. We want to keep all those connections. So what the monarch decline is telling us is that we're not doing a very good job of sustaining all those habitats out there, and that we're losing a lot of the wildlife that goes with that. And the question is, are we going to allow that to continue, or are we going to do something about it? And so what we're trying to persuade people to do is to think differently. Let's think about those marginal areas. Let's think about our hobbies about sitting on a mower and mowing 2 acres around our house. Let's think about that a little bit, because that may not be in our long-term best interest. First of all, we're putting a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere by doing that. Secondly, we're not sustaining the system that sustains us. We lose those pollinators out there because we're losing monarch butterflies. We'll lose the connections to a lot of plants. The services out there that those pollinators provide are of tremendous value in maintaining the biodiversity out there. I mean, the pollinators provide the services for about 70% of the plants out there, and that produces all the fruits, nuts, berries, seeds, foliage, and roots that everything else feeds on. So you lose your pollinators, you lose all those connections, and you lose other species. It's kind of a cascading sort of effect. You know, you can say, well, you know, it's like pulling rocks out of a wall, or the keystone sort of concept. You pull out the keystone and everything collapses. Well, the pollinators are your keystone out there. They're the things that keep everything connected. And that's what we want to do. We want to keep things connected. So that's the pitch. It's more than monarchs, but the monarchs are important as well.
So that would mean like statewide organizations taking on commitments to really plant large tracts.
Yeah, and those are coming together. That's one of the interesting things that's happening. There are people in Kentucky, there are people in Iowa, there are people in Virginia that are really kind of getting the message and recognizing that we do have to get involved with large-scale restoration. There's even some moves in Texas and Oklahoma along these lines. So yes, people are beginning to recognize the need for habitat restoration on a large scale. This takes off from things that have been going on kind of out of sight for most people, with a lot of interest in native plants is developing. There's native plant societies in a lot of different states now focusing on habitat restoration, mostly on private land, but we need to move that off the private land sort of venue and move it into the public landscape sort of approach as well. And we're getting some of the states and some of the agencies to pay attention to this as well.
And why do you think that people care so much about monarch butterflies? What is it?
You know, there's a lot of reasons that this is an iconic species. I mean, it's slow. It presents itself to you. It's pretty. It's beautiful. The caterpillars are interesting. Almost every kid that lives in the Midwest has had some experience raising monarch caterpillars. And the transformation that take place from egg to caterpillar to pupa or chrysalis, and that chrysalis being this startling emerald green with gold dots on it, I mean, it just captures imagination. And then this big, beautiful butterfly comes out of that chrysalis, and And you can hold it in your hands. And you know, it's an accessible insect, and it's a beautiful insect. And then it goes on this magnificent migration. It has this absolutely wondrous annual cycle. I think this whole, everything about this species captures the imagination.
Now, right here at MU, we have a beautiful campus that is actually a botanic garden. KBIA's Sarah Kellogg talked with Mizzou Botanic Garden Director Pete Millier at the school's butterfly garden.
The University of Missouri is home to 755 acres of plantings and landscaping. Labeling, detailed record keeping, and educational programs make the university a botanic garden. I spent a Friday afternoon with the director of the botanic garden, Pete Millier, in the university's butterfly garden.
We try to emphasize natives or well-adapted non-natives.
How do you implement, then, the Missouri plants alongside the non-natives?
You have to take into consideration growth habits. Where does one do well? Does it do well in shade, light sun, all-day sun? You just have to pair them up, you know, with their growth characteristics and also their needs. Some of them don't need a lot of water, which is great because we don't have much irrigation on the campus.
How much of a challenge is it then to maintain a botanic garden on a campus this size?
It is an exciting and wonderful challenge to have. You have to have the soul of a farmer because you are at the mercy of the weather, and that dictates what you can do, when you can do it, how you can do it, and why you do it. But it really boils down to we get to do some really fantastic stuff that is appreciated by a lot of people. And who wouldn't want to have a very supportive audience like that?
Are you trying to always introduce new local plants into the system of Missouri, like with the landscaping?
We are. It's not necessarily new because they've been here a while. But what we're trying to do is get people to understand that there's a little different aesthetic. If we look at this butterfly garden, it's designed to benefit the butterflies, not necessarily our consideration for what we think a neat and well-groomed garden would be. Butterfly gardens, sometimes habitat gardens, they're decidedly kind of wild and woolly, and that's because the insects or birds or whatever you're trying to attract don't really care what it looks like. They just want it to function. The planting that I would like to see us expand more upon is anything that will support native pollinators. Native pollinators need our help.
Are there plans in the future to plant more plants that would attract pollinators?
Yes, there is. Today I was in Marshall, Missouri, working with a company that wants to have monarch way stations, which also support native pollinators, at every one of their facilities in the state of Missouri. So we're hoping that the facility in Marshall is the first one, and it's the first of many more to come. It's an interesting proposition in that we work with living organisms that all have life cycles. It's something that we can kind of set the tone of the discussion about how to do it in our community, our county, and our state by what we do here on the campus. And that's why we have the very strong interest in supporting native pollinators, because there's everything that flows from that. There's a whole plethora of insects that benefit from it. Some of these insects we don't like very much, but that insect population supports another higher organism that depends upon it for food, the birds that eat them, and so on. So we're going to look to do more of that in the future so that we're demonstrating these cycles in the natural world that we need in our lives.
Thanks to Sarah Kellogg and Pete Millier, director of the Mizzou Botanic Garden, for that conversation. Also here in Missouri, the Missouri Prairie Foundation works to conserve our state's prairies, which are, of course, filled with native plants. I talked with Prairie Foundation Director Carol David in a native plant garden she helped plant in Jefferson City. There were many plants in that garden, and among them, milkweed.
In Missouri, there are actually about 18 different species of milkweed, and they grow everywhere from an aquatic milkweed that grows in the bootheel in the swamps to things like butterfly milkweed that is a bright orange-red, beautiful plant for home landscaping, and that grows in nature on prairies. There's swamp or marsh milkweed that grows normally in nature in wetter areas, wetlands, and that has a pink, beautiful pink flower. There's common milkweed, which is a pretty robust plant with, at this time of year, really leathery leaves, and that has a globe, sort of dusty pink flower that smells, it's to die for. The smell is fabulous. And so, again, all of those flowers provide nectar for a whole host of adult butterflies, but again, it's the foliage that's so critical for the larvae or the caterpillars. The butterfly milkweed, which is the bright orange, sort of deep red, deep orange reddish flower, is especially good for home landscaping because it's kind of clump-like. So it's better for maybe a little bit more of a formal type of a garden.
How can these little sorts of gardens ever fight against that sort of massive habitat loss?
Remember that in the United States, I think the figure is something like 45 million acres of lawn that we have. That's a lot of acreage. So, you know, if you think about turf grass as being a crop, you know, that's 45 million acres. So we have to remember that we can all do something to help monarch butterfly conservation. You know, planting even 3 to 4 milkweeds in a garden along with some native nectar plants can go a long way. Monarch adult butterflies, when they begin their spring migration northward from Mexico, they don't just fly from Mexico nonstop up to, you know, northern Minnesota or someplace like that. They are traveling along the way, you know, so they might fly into Texas, they find milkweed, the females, the monarchs reproduce, the females lay eggs, the caterpillars hatch from the eggs, they turn into feeding machines, you know, grow, you know, 2,000 times their, you know, size when they hatch, turn into adults. That generation may stay in that area if there's habitat there for them. They may continue migrating northward. So you have several generations in North America before that last generation of the season and enters what's called reproductive diapause, and it does not reproduce, but then it makes the journey all the way south to Mexico, and it's using its fat reserves. So monarchs need habitat. They need food sources all throughout their range. If you think about monarch migration as being this north-south conveyor belt, you know, it's not just this one shot up and down, you know, north, south. They're moving in this sort of conveyor belt along the way, stopping, reproducing, growing, continuing northward, and then, you know, heading south, you know, at this time of year, starting, you know, late August, September, early October.
And I think the Prairie Foundation I was reading has also worked with local nurseries and growers to help people be able to access milkweed plants.
Yes, in addition to our land conservation efforts, we also run the Grow Native program. This is a 15-year-old program. We're celebrating our 15th anniversary this year, 2015. This is a program whose goal is to increase the use of native plants in developed or altered landscapes. And by developed or altered, I mean anything outside of a naturally occurring natural community, like a forest or a prairie or a wetland or a glade and so forth. We carry out our mission a couple of ways. One, by educating consumers about the many benefits of native plants. And secondly, by marketing the products and services of our professional Grow Native members. We have Grow Native members who are native plant nurseries, retail garden centers, landscape architects, landscape designers, educators, and other groups. And we produce a resource guide with all of the contact information of these businesses as a marketing tool to help consumers find where to buy plants or seed. And seed producers, that's another big category too, because without those seed producers, I mean, they're the basis of providing, you know, plants for this whole industry. We also this year produced a new line of plant tags. You know, if you go to a retail garden center and you want to buy a plant, you usually see a tag tucked into the pot that gives you the information about the plant, the name of the plant and the growing conditions and so forth. This year we produced 7 new tags called Monarch Cafe, and they are tags for 7 different species of milkweeds. And so that's a wonderful tool to help our Grow Native members who are growers help sell their product. For decades and decades and decades, we think of landscaping as exterior decorating, something that's supposed to just look pretty. Well, today, our concept of landscaping has widened considerably, which is very important. We realize now that by choosing native plants, we're choosing plants that have a real purpose in sustaining natural systems. If we choose native plants that are appropriate to a given place, we're providing food for pollinators. The deep roots of native prairie plants and many other native plants are helping to hold soil, prevent soil erosion. Those qualities in turn help protect water quality in streams. Many native plants require fewer inputs, for example, of water, very little fertilizer. Native plants do require water when you're first establishing them, but except in times of extreme drought, they really need. I haven't watered this garden all year. Of course, it has been a wetter year. But last year, when we established this in June of 2014, watered for the first few weeks, and then that was it.
So this garden pretty much takes care of itself.
It does, but I don't want to imply that you can plant native plants and then walk away. The same concepts of landscaping and landscape design apply to native landscapes as other ones in terms of, you know, it's appropriate, it's important to pick the right plant for the right place. You may not want, you know, a plant that can grow 12 feet tall along your sidewalk. You know, you may not want that. So there's going to be weeding. It's not a maintenance-free landscape. So when you're choosing to landscape with native plants, you are committing to not just a beautiful landscape, but you're increasing the ecological functionality of your landscape. And it's a new way of thinking about landscapes. When I go out to my native gardens around my house, I'm looking at what's in bloom, but I'm also looking at the insect life. What insect is visiting what plant? How many new pipevine swallowtail caterpillars do I have? What are the are there any predators, other insect predators of some of those other insects? So it really makes your garden come alive. And the reason native plants are so important as opposed to non-native plants is plants that we have conventionally used in landscaping that come from other parts of the world, well, they've developed in other parts of the world and evolved with insects in those areas. So when you suddenly bring a plant to Missouri, say a hosta, well, insects here haven't evolved with that plant. They don't know what to do with it. So once we can make that leap in our aesthetic, you know, our appreciation of the aesthetics of a garden, it's really life enriching.
That was Carol David, Executive Director of the Missouri Prairie Foundation, talking with us about the benefits of native plants. We've talked a lot about native plants on this show, and you may be wondering, where does one get them? Do I have to wander the state in search of seeds? Well, you don't have to, because people at Missouri Native Plant Nurseries are already raising them. One of those people is Mervyn Wallace at Missouri Wildflowers Nursery in Jefferson City. Intersections' Kara Tabor met Mervyn for a conversation.
Aquatic milkweed. And it grows in standing water. It can grow in standing water.
That's Mervyn Wallace. He's showing me some of the native bounty at his nursery, Missouri Wildflowers. Wallace, who's owned the nursery for 31 years, grows plants that help make up the base of the Missouri food chain.
All of the native wildlife, wild animals, insects, whatever, need native plants. And the documentation is there that shows that there's hardly anything eating the exotic plants compared to the native plants. The numbers are way down. And having holes in your leaves is a good thing. That means you've got interaction with the environment if you've got plants that are doing that. And you're not going to see that with exotic plants very much. compared to the native ones.
What would you say are some of the most popular native plants that you have here?
It's got to be the milkweeds. Everybody wants them because of the monarch butterflies. The milkweeds are essential for the monarch's reproduction. The caterpillars just eat milkweeds, or the vines that are related to the milkweeds. So everybody's after that right now.
Have you seen an increase in demand for native plants?
2014, our growth was 31% higher than 2013. And this year, the first half of this year, our growth was 20% higher than last year. It's just skyrocketed in just very recently.
What are some of the other native plants that have been really popular?
Well, the echinacea, which is coneflowers, there's four species of those in Missouri. The blazing stars, these are all plants that produce a lot of nectar that butterflies and bees use. Any of the asters, but New England aster is very popular, and we sell a lot of them. And it's in bloom when the monarchs migrate, and that's a big selling point for it.
When customers come in and they're looking for particular plants, what kind of benefits are they looking for?
Unlike going to a regular lawn and garden center, which ours isn't, the customers are thinking about birds or butterflies or something about the habitat that they're doing. Some of them just want to plant a prairie garden, for example, enjoy everything that comes along with it. They're not thinking about how pretty this plant is necessarily in many cases, although many of the plants that are native are very attractive. And I guess an important thing that they need to consider is the bloom times, because you're growing perennials and they all have a different bloom period. So it's important to plant more than one species as opposed to planting the annuals you get at a box store or a place like that.
What would you say is your favorite part about growing and selling native plants?
Oh, my favorite part is going out and harvesting the seed out of prairies and just looking out there and paying attention to what's happening in the prairies and analyzing in my head why it's happening this year the way it's happening versus the way it did last year, and all the activities that have caused certain things to happen, like good flowering or bad flowering.
That was Mervyn Wallace of Missouri Wildflowers Nursery and Kara Tabor of Intersections Community Outreach Team. Thanks for spending your time with us here at Intersection, conversations with our community. I want to thank our producers, Katie Eisterhold and Daniela Vidal, and our community outreach team of Helen Tien and Kara Tabor, who are always working to engage with you. So give us a like on Facebook and tell us what topics interest you. And of course, thank you to our guests, Chip Taylor, Pete Millier, Carol David, and Mervyn Wallace. Our music is Montana Skies. Please join us next week at 6:30 p.m. on Monday as we talk about graduate student mobilization at Mizzou. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection, right here on KBIA 91.3 FM.